It occurred to me that the reason for this shield of talk was to protect her elation. When I returned for my final visit with my new friends on the right, I encountered a variety of responses to Donald Trump, about half for, half not. Janice Areno, the team loyalist, had become a stout Trump defender, as were others in her family and office. She remained undisturbed by the controversy he stirred, saying simply, "The country is going to hell in a handbasket, and we need a strong leader to get back on track." A good number in the Sunday gatherings at Cappy and Faye's home in Longville found much to admire in Trump. For Donnie McCorkadale, Trump could be the cowboy-in-chief. As for Mike Schaff, the Tea Party sinkhole activist, his first choice was Texas Senator Ted Cruz, despite the fact that Cruz had received $1 million in campaign funding from oil and gas since 2011 and had described the EPA as unbelievably abusive. For Mike, the important things were small government, low taxes, guns, and the prohibition of abortion. But if Cruz lost the primary, Mike, like his wife and all but one of his six siblings, would vote for Donald Trump. Not everyone planned to. Jackie Tabor, the worshipper, said in an email, "Trump scares me, which is too bad because he's obviously an amazing businessman, which would be pretty great considering the current state of the nation's finances." Harold and Annette Areno, the deeply committed Pentecostal couple living on Bayou Din, recoiled at Trump's ridicule of a disabled man. Sharon Galicia, once president of Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana and an aspirant for a position in the state Republican Party, told me, "I think he's mean, but the plant workers I sell insurance to all think he's great." And if he becomes the Republican nominee, Trump has her reluctant vote, too. One relocated refugee from Bayou Corn agreed. "I like what Trump says, but I'm afraid of what he'd do," and was unsure how he would vote. What many admired about Trump was his success as a businessman. He was a champion of private enterprise, they felt, and that fact had great appeal. During the Depression of the 1930s, a number of Americans turned to a belief in socialism and communism, idealizing the central government and believing in leaders who represented their elation-inspired faith in it. During the current economic downturn, some on the far right have placed a parallel faith in capitalism. Implicitly, Trump promised to make men great again, too. Both fist-pounding, gun-toting guys, and high-flying entrepreneurs. To white, native-born, heterosexual men, he offered a solution to the dilemma they had long faced as the left-behinds of the 1960s and 1970s celebration of other identities. Trump was the identity politics candidate for white men. And he didn't actively oppose medical care for those in need. If he got elected, you could sign up for Trump care and feel manly, too. Around the world in the early 21st century, as the multinational companies that roam the globe become more powerful than the political states vying for their favor, it is the right wing that is on the move. Right-wing regimes, focused on national sentiment, strong central rule, and intolerance for minorities or dissent, have come to power in Russia, where President Putin has declared dissident voices as a sign of weakness and Western influence, in India, where the Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, has declared India a Hindu nation, in Hungary, where anti-Soviet monuments are being replaced by anti-German ones, and in Poland, which is cracking down on a free press. It is becoming more vocal in France, the National Front, Germany, the National Democratic Party, and the United Kingdom, the Independence Party. Versions of the deep story seem to have gone global. 16. They say there are beautiful trees. During the 8 years Bobby Jindal was governor of Louisiana, he fired 30,000 state employees and furloughed many others. Social workers increased their caseloads. Child abuse victims were for the first time spending nights at government offices. Since 2007-2008, in the nation's second poorest state, Governor Jindal had cut funding for higher education by 44%. At the historically black Southern University, General Russell Honoré's alma mater, mold spread on building walls and rats scurried through dormitories. Most campus offices would operate 2 or 3 days a week. Given cuts to the state's judicial branch, in which 8 out of 10 of the accused rely on public defenders, lawyers had been laid off, and the accused languished in jails. 60 in New Orleans alone. Their names on waiting lists with thousands of others, no lawyers to defend them. At the same time, the state faced a projected shortfall of $1.6 billion. Now even more cuts to the public budget were looming. Jindal's successor, Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards, reluctantly announced in March of 2016 that in order to address the historic fiscal crisis, the state would need nearly $3 billion, almost $650 per resident, just to keep up regular services during the next 16 months. Jindal had cut corporate taxes, as well as individual taxes, and he had spent $1.6 billion in incentives to lure industry to the state, offering companies 10-year tax exemptions. Jindal had sold state-owned parking lots and farmland, potential sources of revenue. He put the state's hospitals in business-friendly hands, for which costs proceeded to rise. He had gambled that oil prices would rise and that companies would reap taxable profits, and he had lost. The entire state of Louisiana had been placed into a sinkhole. Nearly every Tea Party advocate I talked to had voted for Jindal twice because he promised to enact their values. But after 8 years of his governance, they hated the result. He had done what he promised, reduced taxes and cut the public sector, but he left the state in shambles. Still, Jindal already seemed forgotten. Speaking of Edwards trying to pick up the pieces, many echoed a comment by Mike Schaff. Now we have a Democratic governor, and the first thing he does is raise taxes. By 2016, Louisiana's financial sinkhole had exacerbated the great paradox. Their beloved Louisiana still ranked 49th out of 50th on general well-being, and 44% of its state budget still came from the dreaded federal government. The state itself was a poor me who had to cut in line in front of other states. A situation worsened by Jindal's policies. But people weren't talking about Jindal or the unmoving great paradox. They knew it was there. They disliked it. But it wasn't on their minds. The deep story was. Victim is the last word my Louisiana Tea Party friends would apply to themselves. They didn't want to be poor me's. As team loyalists, worshippers, and cowboys, they are proud to endure the difficulties they face. But in the loss of their homes, their drinking water, and even their jobs in non-oil sectors of the economy, there is no other word for it. They are victims. Indeed, Louisianans are sacrificial lambs to the entire American industrial system. Left or right, we all happily use plastic combs, toothbrushes, cell phones, and cars. But we don't all pay for it with high pollution. As research for this book shows, red states pay for it more, partly through their own votes for easier regulation, and partly through their exposure to a social terrain of politics, industry, television channels, and a pulpit that invites them to do so. In one way, people in blue states have their cake and eat it too, while many in red states have neither. Paradoxically, politicians on the right appeal to this sense of victimhood even when policies such as those of former Governor Jindal exacerbate the problem. In the meantime, left and right need one another, just as the blue coastal and inland cities need red state energy and rich community. The rural Midwest and South need the cosmopolitan outreach to a diverse, wider world. As sociologist Richard Florida notes, blue state knowledge economies run on red state energy. Red state energy economies, in their turn, depend on dense coastal cities and metro areas, not just as markets and sources of migrants, but for the technology and talent they supply. In my travels, I was humbled by the complexity and height of the empathy wall. But with their teasing, good-hearted acceptance of a stranger from Berkeley, the people I met in Louisiana showed me that, in human terms, the wall can easily come down. And issue by issue, there is possibility for practical cooperation. Left and right in Congress now agree on the goal of reducing the prison population. Young conservatives are far more likely than their elders to care about the environment. The last time I saw Mike Schaff, he surprised me with another crossover issue. "Big money escalates our differences. Let's get it out of politics, both sides." Now, seated back at my desk in California, with the names of my new friends in my address book and with hopes of continued contact, I gaze out my study window. Gray clouds are rising in the far distance to the north. The Richmond Chevron oil refinery on the east shore of the San Francisco Bay. I'm reminded that the issues raised by Bayou Din are not so far away. The 1969 Union oil spill in the waters outside Santa Barbara, California, was at the time the largest in the United States. And there are others elsewhere. Blue states are cleaner than red states, but the challenge is nationwide and growing. For after decades of improvement, since 2009, rates of air, water, and land pollution have been rising again across the nation. The focus in this book on the keyhole issue, environmental pollution, is a keen reminder of the great importance to us all of what, beyond deep stories and politics, is at stake. If I were to write a letter to a friend on the liberal left, I would say, why not get to know some people outside your political bubble? Set aside Ayn Rand. She's their guru, but you won't find people personally as selfish as her words would lead you to expect. You'll probably meet some very fine people who will teach you volumes about strong community, grit, and resilience. You may assume that powerful right-wing organizers, pursuing their financial interests, hook right-wing grassroots adherents by appealing to the bad angels of their nature, their greed, selfishness, racial intolerance, homophobia, and desire to get out of paying taxes that go to the unfortunate. As I saw at the Trump rally in New Orleans, some of that appeal goes on, but that appeal obscures another, to the right-wing's good angels, their patience in waiting in line in scary economic times, their capacity for loyalty, sacrifice, and endurance, qualities of the deep story self. Consider the possibility that, in their situation, you might end up closer to their perspective. If I were to write a letter to my Louisiana friends on the right, I might say, many progressive liberals aren't satisfied with the nation's political choices any more than you are, and many see themselves in some parts of your deep story. As one 60-year-old white, female, San Francisco-based elementary school teacher put it, "I'm a liberal, but hey, I can sympathize with that part about waiting in line." I know the goals you have in mind. Vital community life, full employment, the dignity of labor, freedom. But will the policies you embrace achieve those goals? You want good jobs and income, of course. You may not want to hear this, but in income and jobs, historically the Democrats have done better than the Republicans. In Bulls, Bears, and the Ballot Box, for example, Bob Dietrich and Lou Goldfarb note that over the last 80 years, on 11 of 12 indicators, the economy has fared better under Democratic presidents than under Republicans. See Appendix C. Still, differences between the parties are otherwise far from clear. Bill Clinton, a Democrat, ushered in an era of deregulation, generally favored by the right, while Richard Nixon, a Republican, initiated environmental regulations, now generally favored by the left. And Louisianans, take a look at Norway. It's a small, capitalist democracy with about the same population as Louisiana, 5 million people. It has a long coast, and its people, like you, look to the water, boats, and fishing. Like you, Norway has oil. One difference between Louisiana and Norway, however, is their philosophy of governance and concept of freedom. Norwegians expect and get a great amount from their elected officials. Norway has the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, $800 billion, and the vast majority of Norwegians live upper-middle-class lives. They enjoy the very high scores in health, education, and overall well-being that come with such affluence. They enjoy freedom from need. We Americans have our own culture, but at our best, we are good at drawing on good ideas from around the world. In the long run, we may be able to liberate ourselves from oil itself, but in the meantime, as an alternative to the Bobby Jindal path, it's worth a look at what could be done to liberate Louisiana from its paradox. As you get to know them, you'll find progressives have their own deep story. One parallel to yours, one they feel you may misunderstand. In it, people stand around a large public square, inside of which are creative science museums for kids, public art and theater programs, libraries, schools, a state-of-the-art public infrastructure available for use by all. They are fiercely proud of it. Some of them built it. Outsiders can join those standing around the square, since a lot of people who are insiders now were outsiders in the past. Incorporation and acceptance of difference feel like American values represented in the Statue of Liberty. But in the liberal deep story, an alarming event occurs. Marauders invade the public square, recklessly dismantle it, and selfishly steal away bricks and concrete chunks from the public buildings at its center. Seeing insult added to injury, those guarding the public square watch helplessly as those who've dismantled it construct private McMansions with the same bricks and pieces of concrete, privatizing the public realm. That's the gist of the liberal deep story, and the right can't understand the deep pride liberals take in their creatively designed, hard-won public sphere as a powerful, integrative force in American life. Ironically, you may have more in common with the left than you imagine. For many on the left feel like strangers in their own land, too. Given our different deep stories, left and right are focused on different conflicts and the respective ideas of unfairness linked to them. The left looks to the private sector, the 1% who are in the overclass, and the 99% among whom are an emerging underclass. This is the flashpoint for liberals. The right looks to the public sector as a service desk for a growing class of idle takers. Robert Reich has argued that a more essential point of conflict is in yet a third location, between Main Street capitalism and global capitalism, between competitive and monopoly capitalism. The major fault line in American politics, Reich predicts, will shift from Democrat versus Republican to anti-establishment versus establishment. The line will divide those who see the game as rigged and those who don't. Ironically, both sides of the political divide are struggling to address the same new and frightening face of global capitalism. In an age of extreme automation and globalization, how can the 90% for whom income is stagnant or falling respond? For the Tea Party, the answer is to circle the wagons around family and church, and to get on bended knee to multinational companies to lure them to you from wherever they are. This is the strategy Southern governors have used to lure textile firms from New England or car manufacturers from New Jersey and California, offering lower wages, anti-union legislation, low corporate taxes, and big financial incentives. For the liberal left, the best approach is to nurture new business through a world-class public infrastructure and excellent schools. An example is what many describe as the epicenter of a new industrial age, Silicon Valley, with Google, Twitter, Apple, and Facebook, and its environs, as well as the electric car and solar industries. The Reds might be the Louisiana model, and to some degree, the Blues are the California one. Interestingly, both respond to the new challenge of global capitalism with a call for activist government, but activist about different things. When Bobby Jindal gave $1.6 billion of Louisiana taxpayer money as incentives to private corporations, he was being a government activist. Liberal politicians calling to restore our crumbling infrastructure are being a different kind of activist. And there are ideas beyond either party yet to be born. I walked down Berkeley's Shattuck Avenue past Cafe Gratitude, a vegan restaurant, since closed, that once a month charged whatever customers wished to pay. I dropped in once a long while ago and wasn't thrilled with the maple coconut bacon, but felt charmed with the idea of the place. Now, I catch myself wondering, would Janice Areno see it as hippy-dippy or as a business with a touch of church? And what about those green, black, and gray recycling bins by my garage? Would Donnie McCorkadale see them as regulatory cement or as a smart idea? Sharon Galicia, the single mother who had taken me with her as she sold medical insurance to plant workers, was planning to run for local office in the Republican Party. But her 15-year-old son was a fan of Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. She was giving her two children a childhood she had never received, taking them to California, Iceland, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, the UK, and Russia, and inviting them to consider many universities, including UC Berkeley. I invited her to stay and to show her son, Berkeley. Who knows what he would think? Our deep stories differ, of course, anchored as they are in biography, class, culture, and region. But I feel great admiration for the people I've met on the other side of the empathy wall. And while my vote will surely differ from theirs, I wish them well. Farewells. With their canoe long upturned by the banks of Bayou Din, near the dead cypress tree stumps that stood vigil over their ordeal, Harold and Annette Areno opened the door to their friend Mike Tritico. It was October 2014. They had long missed the evening racket of the frogs, the sound of jumping fish, and a sense of trust in their land and water. Mike sat with them in their living room and solemnly delivered bad news. Their lawsuit over the harmful pollution of the waters had been thrown out. The Arenos had never been compensated for illness or lost value to their property, not to mention the mental anguish of living with a larger cultural amnesia about their plight. With Mike Tritico's help, Harold and 21 others, including Lee Sherman, had filed a class-action lawsuit in 1996 against a number of companies, including Pittsburgh Plate Glass. Now, after 18 years, it had been dismissed for lack of evidence. Nothing, the court said, connected pollution to deliberate harm to humans. So the Arinos were left as prisoners of their lost paradise. Rememberers. Meanwhile, like the lawsuit, talk of cleaning up Bayou Din had dragged on lackadaisically for decades. At last, in February 2015, a cleanup crew had been stirred into action. The contaminated sediment from the bottom of 700 acres of the bayou was to be dredged and pumped into an open containment pool. Along the bottom of the bayou, workers would lay down a reinforced concrete mat and place 6 inches of clean sediment on top of it.
"They say it really doesn't have to be a perfectly sealed clean layer," one local official remarked about the cleanup. "As long as you reduce the chemical concentrations on the surface, you're okay."
But Mike Tritico saw potential danger.
"What's going to happen to the large, uncovered pool the toxics have been removed to? Tropical Storm Bill in June 2015 almost raised its level so high it overflowed," he told me.
On the other side of the Arinos' home, a South Korean firm has contracted with Axiall, the former Pittsburgh Plate Glass, to build a large ethane cracker and monoethylene glycol plant. At a small public gathering of residents to air their views of the new plant, Harold said,
"To y'all, this is progress."
But whether it is or not depends on which side of the fence you're on. Noise from the plant was so loud one night that he rose from bed to read the Bible until 2:30 a.m. when it finally died down. In my last phone conversation with Annette, she explained that at certain times on certain days, odors from the plant keep them from stepping outside. One day when I was thinking and writing about him, Lee Sherman, the man who held up the "I'm the one who dumped it" sign, telephoned me. Now 83, Lee had been tuning up his racing cars, leaning along one wall of his garage, is that stack of 30 plastic lawn signs Lee plans to plant in local lawns for the EPA-cutting Tea Party candidate, John Fleming.
"It's a little harder now I'm crippled up, but I get myself sitting down with my screwdriver and hammer," Lee reminds me. "The signs stay pretty good."
In Longville, Mike Tritico and Donnie McCorkadale had been visiting Brother Cappy and Sister Faye's and arguing about Donald Trump, I heard. Mike was against, Donnie was for. Cappy and Faye's cousin, Brother Michael, in training to become a minister, was considering setting up a Pentecostal church in the Marina neighborhood of San Francisco. "There are a lot of single people there, without family," Michael said. "I think I could do some good." Madonna Massey, the lively gospel singer who took Rush Limbaugh as her brave heart, was shocked to discover that her teenage daughter, Chapel, had downloaded Anaconda on her iPad, a video of the highly popular, black, scantily clad diva, Nicki Minaj, doing buttock mobilizing twerking. When Chapel returned from school, Madonna spanked her, banished her iPad, unhinged her bedroom door, and stored it in the garage for a month. "Minaj is at the top of Billboard Top 100. Look at the culture we've got to protect our kids from," Madonna told me the last time I saw her. Jackie Tabor, who had said, "Sunday is my favorite day," flew her family to Israel to see the Holy Land. "We were the youngest couple on the trip," she recounted. She has also opened a gym called On a Roll, featuring stationary bicycling, energetic music, and healthy vegetable drinks in downtown Lake Charles. Jackie was back to being her mother's girl, the organizer, the leader. In one promo video, some 30 people were featured cycling to rhythmic music, facing a vista of lush green countryside on a giant TV screen. At the end of my last visit to Janice Arino, we passed her great array of colorful elephants, and as we headed out the door together, Janice adjusted the thermostat so the air conditioning would go off. "See," she said with an impish grin, "I'm a green person." At the last meeting of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, a Benelli Super Black Eagle II shotgun was raffled off. Proceeds were to be used to promote pillows for the troops, college scholarships, and assistance to military families. A tense split had opened between those who would vote for Donald Trump gleefully and those who would do so reluctantly. A few didn't know what to do. The lifelong red-blue friends, Sally Capel and Shirley Slack, now live in different towns. Sally in Lake Charles, Shirley in Opelousas. They talk two or three times a week by phone and avoid mention of Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. Sally is deeply upset about the GMO monster Monsanto. Shirley frets about skyrocketing national debt. They recently flew together to Cleveland to see Shirley's daughter perform as a professional ballerina in the Ohio Ballet. As for the friends living around Lake Charles, the last time I visited with them, most were still driving back and forth across the spooky I-10 bridge between Lake Charles and Westlake, but most did not link their distrust of the bridge to the EDC spill. Former Bayou Corn residents had dispersed in every direction, some to Mississippi and Texas. The community of Belle Rose, next to Bayou Corn, was deserted. Nearly. Twice a refugee from industrial accidents, one a 2003 methane leak from Dow Chemical, and one the sinkhole caused by the Texas brine drill. An auto mechanic lives with his wife in a trailer on the ruined grounds of his old home near the sinkhole. Two couples relocated to the sprawling suburbs of Baton Rouge, over 100 miles to the north. "We hate the area. We're just here to be near our son," one retired emergency response worker declared, while her husband, a retired 12-wheeler truck driver, nodded in agreement. Another refugee couple, now living hours away from former neighbors, spoke lovingly of good times past. Nick, a retired postal worker, shared a large color photo of himself, smiling in a white suit, cummerbund, and straw hat, among a dozen colorfully costumed neighbors. Clown, Indian, cowboy, king and queen, drinks held high, celebrating Mardi Gras in Bayou Corn before the disaster. "I used to collect driftwood along the shore of Bayou Corn for my wife to paint and sell." He pointed to pieces of painted driftwood. "But we can't do that now." The last time I visited Mike Schaff's abandoned home on Crawfish Stew Street in Belle Rose with him, the rosebush was dead. A few shingles had dropped from the roof, and there were signs of an attempted break-in. 38 feral cats, now called the Cajun Kitties of Bayou Corn, were wandering about. Mike and his wife had moved from their ruined home near the sinkhole into a beautiful, large fixer-upper on a canal flowing into Lake Verrette. Some mailboxes along his street were shaped like open-mouthed fish. His new home was not far from where his father had long ago pulled him along as a 3-year-old boy in a small plastic tub as he checked his crawfish nets. Mike was back on the water. He had jacked up the living room floor, redone the bedroom molding, put in a new deck, and set up his airplane building kit in the garage for later. A recent tornado had ripped the American flag from the pole extending from his garage, but it hadn't harmed the Confederate flag hanging from the porch of his next-door neighbor. Mike's new home lay near the entrance to the spillway of the magnificent Atchafalaya Basin, an 800,000-acre national wildlife refuge, the largest bottomland hardwood swamp in the country, overseen, in part, by the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Mike took me in his flatboat into this extraordinary basin to fish for perch. He pointed out a bald eagle on the bare branch of a tall cypress, a soaring white egret, a long-legged spoonbill watching for fish. But, he explained,
I've gone from the frying pan to the fire. They are disposing of millions of gallons of fracking waste. The industry calls it produced water, right here in the basin. It can contain methanol, chloride, sulfates, radium. And they're importing it from Pennsylvania and other fracking sites to go into an injection well near here. Salt can corrode the casing of those wells, and it's not far from our aquifer.
In 2015, the Texas state legislature effectively forbade any local bans of fracking and waste disposal, rendering them unenforceable. I asked Mike who he was planning to back for U.S. president. His first choice was Tea Party favorite, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who had received $15 million in super PAC contribution from fracking billionaires Farris and Dan Wilkes, calls fracking a providential blessing, and adamantly opposes bans on it. Cruz has also called for gutting clean water protection, limiting citizens' access to the courts, and exempting power plants from having to comply with air standards. Like Mike, he didn't believe in man's role in climate change, and he called for cuts in research on its effects. Indeed, in the 2015 voting scores kept by the National League of Conservation Voters across 25 environmental issues, Ted Cruz won a score of 0 out of a possible 100 points. His lifetime score was 5. Still, Mike had to balance his powerful dislike of the federal government against his desire to protect the great majesty of the Atchafalaya Basin and prevent future waves of environmental refugees. He didn't want to vote for the Menshevik or the Bolshevik, so that left Ted Cruz. And if Cruz didn't win the Republican nomination, I asked,
I'll vote for Donald Trump.
On my last visit to Harold and Annette Areno at Bayou Din, Harold told me he couldn't be sure, but these days maybe the water was looking a bit clearer. Then he kindly walked me across his driveway and opened my car door. I got in and opened the window on the driver's side. Now in his mid-80s, Harold looked out at his beloved bayou, where once majestic cypress had held out their moss shawls as if sashaying up the bayou and beyond. I recalled the photographs he'd shown me of them. Then Harold leaned on the window and told me, slowly,
I don't know when I'll see you next. Only the angel Gabriel knows when each of our times come. But when it does, and gravity leaves our feet, and we rise up, I know I'll see you up there. And they say there are beautiful trees in heaven.
Appendix A. The Research. This book is based on a kind of research sociologists describe as exploratory and hypothesis-generating. The goal of it is not to see how common or rare something is, or where one does and doesn't find it, or to study how the something comes and goes through time, although I draw on the research of others who address such questions. My goal has been to discover what that something actually is. I've long been fascinated by the emotional draw of right-wing politics. That's my something. It took getting close, and that determined my choice of method. As with my other books based on this method, the second shift, working families and the revolution at home, the time bind, when home becomes work and work becomes home, the managed heart, the commercialization of human feeling. I adapted my approach to the subject at hand. Decisions about sample selection, interviewing method, participant observation, profile selection, statistical analysis, all were the best ways I could think of to get close to the something. My first step was to conduct 4 focus groups, 2 of Tea Party supporters and 2 of Democrats, all composed of middle-class white women from Lake Charles, Louisiana. I then did follow-up interviews with nearly all of the conservative women and, sometimes in a method social scientists call snowball sampling, with their husbands, parents, and neighbors. A member of one of the right-wing focus groups invited me to join the monthly luncheons of Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, and this gave me the opportunity to talk to those around the luncheon table and do follow-up interviews. One was with the Pentecostal minister's wife, whom you meet in Chapter 8. She, in turn, introduced me to many members of her church, invited me to a church social, and opened a window into that community. Following another path, I followed 2 rival congressional candidates on their campaign trails. The differences between their positions seemed very small to my Berkeley eyes, but loomed large to many in Louisiana. At every campaign event, I tried to talk to the person next to me, who sometimes introduced me to still others. At a union hall meet and greet for a Tea Party candidate in Rain, for example, a kind man took it upon himself to introduce me around a large picnic table to mainly retired white male workers. "Y'all, this lady is from California, and she's writing a book." A Lake Charles-born environmental activist, Mike Tritico, who appears throughout this book, had many deeply conservative, Tea Party, anti-environmentalist friends with whom he kept in close touch. I asked him if I could tag along as he visited with them. It was in this way that I came to attend a number of Sunday after-church luncheons at the home of Brother Cappy and Sister Faye Brantley, Chapter 12, and to listen in on some of Mike's arguments with Donnie McCorkadale. Recognizing the importance of their debate for this book, I began attending public rallies on the environment. It was at such a rally that I met 2 people, Mike Schaff, a Tea Party advocate, and General Russell Honoré. To learn more about Honoré's capacity to talk effectively to those normally hostile to the environmentalist outlook, I followed him around for a day, listening to him speak to both businessmen and victims of extreme pollution. He also took me on a tour of the strip of oil and petrochemical plants along the Mississippi between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, known as Cancer Alley, which I describe in Chapter 4. Altogether, I talked with 60 people and accumulated over 4,000 pages of transcribed interviews. 40 of these were people who embraced the principles of the Tea Party. An additional 20 helped me understand the core group. They included scientists, academics, 2 former members of the Louisiana legislature, ministers, a newspaper reporter, a librarian and volunteer river watcher, 2 professors, a former director of the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, a former assistant attorney general of Louisiana, an environmental chemist, a marine biologist, and a mayor. 8 of this latter group were black. I spent a day, for instance, with a black, male, disabled plant operator living in a trailer surrounded by land rezoned as heavy industrial and owned by Sasol, a large petrochemical company. His water and electricity had been cut off, and the mailman would no longer deliver his mail. But at the time I saw him, he was determined never to leave his home. When I met my interviewees, I gave them my consent form, set up my tape recorder, and offered to turn it off anytime they asked. A number of times they did, and those discussions are either reported in a way that completely separates the event from the person who told me of it, or not reported at all. From among my 40 core interviews, I chose 6 to profile as they most clearly and richly exemplified patterns of thinking and feeling that I'd noticed in many others among the 40. With these 6 people, I also did what sociologists call participant observation, visiting places of birth, churches, and burial plots, sharing meals, driving places together, attending events, and more. Of the core group, roughly half were women and half were men. All were white and between the ages of 40 and 85. Their occupations placed them in the middle, lower middle, and working class. Roughly one-third worked or had worked for oil directly, for example as pipe fitters, or indirectly, for example as suppliers. And two-thirds were in lines of work unrelated to oil. Teachers, secretaries, a flight attendant, and a trailer park owner, for example. Interestingly, attitudes across these groups varied very little. Back in Berkeley, with the great help of 2 research assistants, both PhD candidates in the UC Berkeley Sociology Department, I set about studying Gallup, General Social Survey, and Pew Opinion Polls. I paid special attention to the degree to which my respondents seemed to reflect, exaggerate, or buck national patterns. Midway through this research, I returned to the General Social Survey with an important new question. What was the link, I became curious to know, between an American's description of him or herself as a strong Republican or strong Democrat, attitudes about regulating pollution, and actual exposure to it? For that research and finding, see Appendix B. Finally, I explored Louisiana. I visited Angola Prison, the largest maximum security prison in the United States, and chatted with a trustee, a lifer in for murder. I attended a reenactment of a Civil War militia skirmish and talked with the reenactors. I attended the Junior Miss Black Pride contest and interviewed the father of the winner, a petrochemical plant worker. I listened to the tour guide at the Oak Alley plantation. The slaves showed industry and skill. I looked through bookstores and libraries and walked all over Lake Charles, noticing mostly whites in the day, blacks in the evening at the public plaza by the edge of the lake. I studied tourist brochures and wedding photographs staged in plantation settings. I ate lunch at a restaurant with a white homeless man, a Republican. I even danced with a stranger at an all-day dancing cafe in Bro Bridge, where my liberal and Tea Party twosome, Sally Capel and Shirley Slack, had mischievously taken me to catch the Cajun spirit of laissez les bon temps rouler. It helped, I think, that I was white, female, gray-haired, and writing a book about a divide that also troubled those I came to know. But what most eased my way was their great personal warmth and famous Southern hospitality, for which I remain deeply grateful. Appendix B. Politics and Pollution. National Discoveries from ToxMap. I had imagined before I came that the more polluted the place in which people live, the more alarmed they would be by that pollution, and the more in favor of cleaning it up. Instead, I found Louisiana to be highly polluted, and the people I talked with to be generally opposed to any more environmental regulation, and, indeed, regulations in general. So, was Louisiana an oddball state in this regard, or not? According to previous research, the more polluted a state is, the more likely it is to vote red. Chapter 5. So, far from being an oddball state, what was true for Louisiana was true nationwide. But what went on within each red state? Was it, as journalist Alec McGillis claimed in the New York Times, that within red states the people facing poverty, poor schools, and broken families didn't show up in political polls because they didn't vote at all. And meanwhile, others living in the same state, two class levels higher, did vote as Republican? If we apply McGillis's logic, we might expect that the people who live near polluting industry wish the polluters were regulated, but don't bother to vote, while Republicans who are richer and live in cleaner places don't think there's a problem, and so reject the idea of regulating polluting industry. Maybe. But a second possibility is more puzzling. Did the same person both face pollution and vote against regulating polluters? Rebecca Elliott and I set about finding out by combining two key sets of data. One was from the General Social Survey, GSS, run by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. The General Social Survey is widely regarded by social scientists as one of the best data sets on social trends in the country. The survey asks people to rate their response on a scale from strongly agree to strongly disagree to such statements as, people worry too much about progress harming the environment. Industrial air pollution is dangerous to the environment. The U.S. does enough to protect the environment. And some people think that the government in Washington is trying to do too many things that should be left to individuals and private business. We received permission from the National Opinion Research Center to analyze 3,000 anonymous answers to these questions in the survey for 2010. The second source of information was the Toxics Release Inventory of the Environmental Protection Agency. The Toxics Release Inventory, TRI, calculates various measures of exposure to toxic chemical releases and waste disposal. Based on reports from industrial and federal facilities, the most comprehensive of TRI measures are called the Risk Screening Environmental Indicators, RSEI. For any particular zip code in the country, it gives us a measure of inhabitants' exposure based on three things: the volume of chemical releases, the degree of toxicity of those chemicals, and the size of the exposed population. We used risk screening information for the matching year 2010. Then we interrelated information on political choice and attitudes about the environment, on one hand, with the actual risk of toxic releases in the county in which a person lives, on the other hand. With the help of Dr. John Stiles, director of UC Berkeley's data lab, and consulting with Professor Mike Hout of the sociology department at New York University, we used bridging software to do this. Using regression analysis, we tested whether the riskiness of where one lives, RSEI score, predicts one's answer to various environment-related questions from the GSS. We also reversed the analytical arrow to see if various sociodemographic and political variables predict the riskiness of the places in which a person lives. We also examined the relationship between riskiness associated with one's place of residence and one's political orientations generally. The most interesting findings are these. As the relative riskiness of the county a person lived in increased, the more likely that person was to agree with the statement, "People worry too much about human progress harming the environment." So the higher the exposure to environmental pollution, the less worried the individual was about it, and the more likely that person was to define him or herself as a strong Republican. Those who identified themselves as male, high income, conservative, Republican, Christian, and strongly religious were also likely to believe that air and water pollution were not a danger. Further, the higher the risk within a person's county, the more likely a person was to agree with the statement that the U.S. is doing more than enough to protect the environment. Again, curiously, The higher a person's exposure to pollution, given their residence, the more likely the individual was to think the United States is, in general, overreacting to the issue. This is a paradox, but not one born of ignorance, for the greater the risk of exposure to pollution, the more individuals are likely to answer, agree, to the statement, industrial air pollution is dangerous to the environment. The better off and more educated among them also expressed the idea that humankind can improve the environment. They disagreed that it is too difficult to do anything about the environment. In the end, red states are more polluted than blue states, and whether an individual does or doesn't vote, conservative and Republican individuals tend to brush aside the environment as an issue and to suffer the consequences by living with higher rates of pollution. The Louisiana story is an extreme example of the politics and environment paradox seen across the nation. Appendix C. Fact-checking common impressions. Often I felt that my new friends and I lived not only in different regions, but in different truths. I would leave an interview wondering myself what the facts really were. So below I offer statements that I frequently heard, as well as the facts, as researched by Rebecca Elliott, based on the most recently available data. The government spends a lot of money on welfare. 8% of the total 2014 U.S. budget was devoted to welfare, benefits that are income needs based. Welfare rolls are up and people on welfare don't work. Since President Bill Clinton declared the end of welfare as we know it in 1996, aid for families with dependent children, AFDC, ended, and temporary assistance for needy families, TANF, with work requirements and time limits, began. TANF, assistance to the nation's poorest families with children, is now 20% below its 1996 levels in 35 states and the District of Columbia. But since the Great Recession of 2008, the number of Americans who receive food stamps, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, has risen above 1995 levels, although that number peaked in 2013 and has fallen steeply since then. Medicaid expenditures have also risen, but, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation study, they are projected to fall to 1999 levels by 2016. Most government aid recipients are children or the elderly. Of Medicaid recipients in 2013, for example, 51% were children under age 18, and 5% were senior citizens over age 65. As for those between the ages of 18 and 64 on all forms of means-tested aid, i.e. welfare, based on 2010 to 2012 data, most work. Of Medicaid or Children's Health Insurance Program recipients, by far the largest recipient list, 61% work. 36% of food stamp recipients and 32% of TANF families work. All earned income tax credit recipients work, but recipients work at jobs that are poorly paid and for which full-time work is unavailable. To turn it around, in 2013, among fast food workers, 52% relied on some form of welfare to supplement low wages paid for full-time work. Among childcare workers, 46% relied on welfare, and among home care workers, 48% did so. In such instances, public taxpayers can be said to make up for low wages offered by some companies. A form, some argue, of corporate welfare. People on welfare depend entirely on money from us taxpayers to live. For the poorest 20% of Americans, Only 37% of their total income in 2011 came from the government. The rest was payment for work.
Everyone who's poor gets a handout.
Not all poor people get government help. According to the U.S. Census Bureau's Survey of Income and Program Participation for 2012, latest available, among families in poverty, 26.2% did not participate in any of the major means-tested benefit programs, i.e. Medicaid, SNAP, TANF/GA, Housing Assistance, or SSI. States also differ one from the other. In Vermont, there are 78 TANF recipients for every 100 poor persons. In Louisiana, the ratio is 4 TANF recipients to every 100 poor people. And, more than one may imagine, the government is helping those at the top. By one estimate, half of all tax benefits go to the richest 20% of Americans. Black women have a lot more children than white women. In the United States in recent years, the fertility rates for white and black women have almost converged. In 2013, the total fertility rate for black women was 1.88 children over the course of a lifetime. For white women, it was 1.75. A lot of people, maybe 40%, work for the federal and state government. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, at the end of 2014, 1.9% of the 143 million American non-farm workers were employed in the civilian sector of the federal government. An additional 1% were in the enlisted military. About 3.5% of workers work for state government, including school and hospital workers. In addition, 9.8% of workers, including public school teachers, work for local government. In 2014, 826,848 people, or 0.58% of all Americans, served in the military reserves. So adding together all military and civilian workers at the federal, state, and local levels, in 2014, less than 17% of Americans worked for the government. Public sector workers are way overpaid. Using the annual social and economic supplement of the current population survey for 2006 and 2007, and comparing public with private sector workers of similar education, experience, sex, race, ethnicity, marital status, full-time, part-time status, number of hours worked, and other variables, researchers reported that private sector workers earn 12% more than their public sector counterparts. Women with advanced degrees earn 21% less than comparable men in the private sector, but only 12% less in the public sector. So while women are underpaid in both sectors, they are less underpaid in the public sector. The same thing is true for blacks. At every level of education, blacks in the public sector earn less than whites, but not as much less as they do in the private sector. In the public sector, they earn 2% less than whites. In the private sector, 13% less. The more environmental regulations you have, the fewer jobs. Nearly all the Tea Party sympathizers I interviewed referred to a trade-off between jobs and environmental protection. The tougher the environmental regulations, the logic goes, the higher the costs to firms who pass that cost on by raising the price of their goods, thereby reducing sales and employment. But does that either-or logic check out? Actually, it does not. A 1993 study that compared states' ratings on strictness of environmental protection with indicators of economic health, overall growth, employment growth, construction growth, over 20 years, found that stronger environmental standards have not limited the relative pace of economic growth. In a 2001 study of new air quality regulations for manufacturing plants in the Los Angeles area, researchers reported no evidence that local air quality regulation, among the strictest in the nation, substantially reduced employment. A 2002 study also analyzed the impact of environmental regulations on four industries that generate significant pollution and might therefore be expected to suffer losses from the effects of environmental regulation. In two of the four industries researchers studied, plastics and petroleum, the net employment impact of the environmental regulations was small but positive. While in the other two industries, pulp and paper and iron and steel, there was no statistically significant impact. Finally, a 2008 study found that investments in environmental protection create some jobs and displace others, but that the net effect on employment is positive. In fact, environmental protection is itself a major sales-generating, job-creating industry. In a comparison of Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, North Carolina, Ohio, and Wisconsin, two researchers reported that stricter environmental policies did not inhibit job growth. Do excessive demands imposed by environmental regulatory agencies lead to massive layoffs? According to the mass layoff statistics kept by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 0.1% of all layoffs were environment and safety related from 1987 to 1990. The most recent data, from 2012, covering 6,500 private non-farm layoff events, show that 45 events, or 0.69% of the total layoffs, were disaster or safety related, including events attributed to hazardous work environment or natural disaster. Only 18 events, or 0.28% of the total, were attributed to government regulations / intervention. Economic incentives and more relaxed regulations are needed to attract oil and gas business that could and would go elsewhere. In 2004, researchers investigated the effects of local fiscal policy on the location decisions of 3,763 establishments that began operations in Maine between 1993 and 1995, and found that businesses favor municipalities that spend high amounts on public goods and services, even when these expenditures are financed by an increase in local taxes. This suggests that a local fiscal policy of reduced government spending to balance a tax cut may attract fewer new businesses than a policy featuring additional spending and higher taxes. There is also recent evidence that suggests, whether or not they work to attract business, governments that rely on incentives may face negative outcomes. A 2010 study, based on an analysis of national surveys of 700 to 1,000 local governments from 1994, 1999, and 2004, that tracked the use of business incentives over time, found that governments that rely most heavily on incentives may face more intergovernmental competition, stagnating or declining economies, and lower tax bases. For such governments, business incentives may contribute to a cycle of destructive competition. State subsidies to industry help increase the number of jobs. An 8-part 2014 investigative special report in The Advocate, Louisiana's largest daily newspaper, was entitled "Giving Away Louisiana." If Louisiana gives away roughly $1.1 billion per year in taxpayer money to corporations as incentives, the team of journalists wanted to know, are citizens getting their money's worth back in jobs? Their answer was no. The Louisiana taxpayer can pay enormous amounts for each job industry brings in. As Gordon Russell writes, when Valero announced an expansion of its Norco operations, creating 43 new jobs, Louisiana promised to cover $10 million of the cost, or nearly $250,000 per job. When jobs do come to Louisiana, it's also not clear that they are in response to subsidies. In 2013, Louisiana paid $240 million in tax exemptions to fracking companies. But, Russell notes, there is little evidence the tax break stimulates drilling. Drilling goes up and down with the availability and price of oil and gas, he says, not with changing amounts of government subsidies. State subsidies to corporations have also been growing faster than the Louisiana state economy. Good Jobs First, a watchdog group that researches the link between government subsidies to corporations and jobs, notes that the 50 states it has surveyed vary in their degree of disclosure. But with that disclaimer, it reports that on a per capita basis, Louisiana gives away more taxpayer money than any other state in the nation. Oil stimulates the rest of the economy. Does the money oil generates stay in Louisiana? Or does it end up leaving the state in the form of executive pay and returns to out-of-state shareholders? To answer this question, we compared Louisiana's gross state product, GSP, to its total personal income, TPI. The more money that leaks out of the state, the larger the difference between GSP and TPI. In other words, if the sum of all personal income is higher than the GSP, it must be going somewhere else because it doesn't add to the gross state product. Based on Bureau of Economic Analysis data, adjusted to 2012 dollars, we provide a measure of leakage as a percent of income from 1997 to 2012. For most years, leakage out of Louisiana is between 20 and 35%. Leakage also varied from year to year, low in 2003 and high in 2005, for example. Local businesses tend not to leak their profits away to other states, while large multinational businesses with operations and headquarters elsewhere do. The economy always does better under a Republican president. For the years 1949 to 2009, unemployment has been lower and gross domestic product has been higher under Democratic presidents. Political scientist Larry Bartels has also shown that inequality has increased greatly under Republican presidents and decreased slightly under Democrats. Recently, economists at Princeton confirmed that the U.S. economy has grown faster under Democratic presidents, who have also produced more jobs, lowered the unemployment rate, generated higher corporate profits and investments, and seen higher stock market returns. They attribute this, however, to the timing of oil shocks and when major technologies debuted that had positive effects on the economy, for example, the internet under Clinton. In other words, some of the correlation is due to factors outside a president's control. Republican presidents have also added far more to federal debt levels than Democrats have, as a percent of GDP. Since 1945, Reagan has added the most, with an almost 60% increase in federal debt to GDP. Presidents Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, and Clinton all managed to reduce debt as a percentage of GDP.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Written by Arlie Russell Hochschild. Performed by Suzanne Torin. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016 by Arlie Russell Hochschild. Production copyright 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.